is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Captain Jerry Hendricks, United States Navy retired aviator of the Sagamore Institute, writing most recently at the National Review Online with his colleague Brent Sadler, Restoring Our Maritime Strength. We are days, hours from a new administration and preparing for the next administration requires a lot of attention to detail immediately. And the Navy is a major component, I've learned over the years from Jerry, most recently in his book, To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. Therefore, the new president-elect must. Jerry, a very good evening to you. Thank you very much. First, I want to look at the scale of the challenge right now. Is the Navy in a position now to move effectively with the new presidency to build what it needs, from the shipyards to the capital ships to the frigates to the submarines? Is it ready to do that, Jerry? Good evening to you.
John, thank you very much. Good to be back with you again. My answer is no. The Navy is talking a good line about wanting to get ready, but at the same time, we'll also bring forth the restrictions upon it, that there are real issues in capacity so far as building new ships. There are real issues in capacity when it comes to repairing the ships that we have. There's also a significant challenge in workforce, whether that's recruiting young sailors and new officers to come into the Navy, or whether it's recruiting workers in our shipyards. The fact is that there are a lot of restrictive behaviors that are going on within our country and within the bureaucracy that's actually limiting the ability of the Navy to expand and expand rapidly. And we see this everywhere. Recently, there was an announcement from one of the major shipbuilders that they were going to actually slow down production of ships that we are behind schedule on, because they're looking downstream and they're seeing that their secondary and tertiary parts suppliers are behind in their deliveries. And so there is no reason to try and accelerate the development or the building of some of these platforms, knowing that they're only going to have delays when it comes time for those parts to be installed. And so we have widespread issues across the industrial base and also issues inside the Navy. Now, our Chief of Naval Operations right now, Admiral Lisa Franchetti, is talking about the need to get the Navy ready for war in 2027. She's put a pin in the map on 2027 and said that this is the time. And so we're starting to see the fleet in many ways come home to get ready in maintenance and training to try and ramp up to have its readiness increase to be ready at sort of this moment of maximum danger, if we would go back to some of the 1950s language. But to say that it's ready today, no, it's not. To say that it's getting ready, I think that there is an attempt, but there are real restrictions upon that forward progress.
We have a binary choice. I begin with the Harris administration. You anticipate that it will continue the Biden administration's low priority for defense and for the Navy, or is there a suggestion in the campaign there will be a change of direction?
Well, John, my colleague, Captain Brent Sadler, and I wrote this essay. And by the way, Brent is a submarine officer, commanded a fast attack submarine during his career. We wrote this in such a way that we wanted to be applicable to either administration, whether it would be a Harris administration or a Trump administration. We wanted to have usable suggestions that could be there for either of them. However, I think that we are both skeptical, and it shows in our writing, as to whether a Harris administration, which thus far hasn't been ready to signify a significant divergence from the Biden administration's policies, would actually pick up the glove and move forward in an aggressive fashion on building out the Navy. The Biden administration has had a leader in Secretary of the Navy, Carlos Del Toro, who has come forward with a number of significant initiatives that are all good. His maritime statecraft ideas are good. I appreciate them and I applaud them. However, what we haven't seen behind them is a plan to actually implement them or the administration send over a budget that could actually fully fund them. So I doubt that that would change under a Harris administration, that, for instance, we would see the Navy get significant more money or have real plans put in place to move forward aggressively with fleet expansion. So I color me skeptical on a Harris administration, whereas Donald J. Trump, ever since his Philadelphia speech in the fall of 2016, has been promoting a 350-ship plus Navy going forward. So we would hope that Trump would pick that up again, that line again, and move forward with great energy.
All right, let's compare and contrast. We've talked over the over many years of how the Navy was preparing for what happened in the 1940s, preparing in the 1930s, and you pointed to the Two Ocean Navy Act of 1940. If Mr. Trump's successful, he will need the Congress. Is the Congress ready to move as effectively as they did in the 1930s looking at Europe?
Well, John, I think that the Congress is open to this, and I think that there's a significant chance that the Republicans will hold in the House and perhaps add into the Senate, which means that there will be a 2-year window of time, really an 18-month period of time, to move forward with some massive legislation. And we specifically raise within this essay the idea of a 100-day plan, recognizing the precedent set during the Franklin D. Roosevelt administration, when Roosevelt was able to pass 15 major funding bills that dramatically reformed and changed the government at that time. We wanted to lay out a plan that's actionable from day one. But I think that actually we may have an alignment in the Congress between a House and a Senate where this would get behind. Now, there is a piece of legislation that's pending right now, which is called the Ships for America Act, that may brought up yet in this Congress that has bipartisan support. But that act is focused largely on the commercial shipbuilding, which I think is important, but a necessary precursor to expand the naval shipbuilding industrial base. And so I think that we would see there's a good chance of being able to move forward legislatively.
Let us move past the Second War into the Cold War. You mentioned that right away in the first 100 days, policy is personnel. Does that mean we're looking at a clean sweep of the Navy? It's happened before. Or are there elements already to initiate the 100-day plan?
Well, John, what we recommend in the essay is that we actually do that the senior leadership, civilian leadership of the Navy. You know, first of all, we need to have a leadership team that's ready as near to day one as possible. So one of the recommendations that we make in this essay is that the Trump team, the transition team, convene almost immediately after the election. Or for that matter, even the Harris team after the election, and select their leadership team in the Department of the Navy. And by that, we mean the Secretary of the Navy, the Undersecretary, and the Assistant Secretaries, that they all be aligned in a strategic direction for growth expansion of the Navy and the modernization of the Navy, and that slate be sent to the Senate for confirmation as soon after the inauguration as possible. And then that leadership team, in turn, would sit down with the senior uniformed leadership of the Navy, review everyone who is currently in their positions with an eye to either retaining them or reassigning them, but to make sure that that leadership team is aligned with the strategic direction of the new administration.
The 1950s, you give an example. It's new to me, but it involves Arleigh Burke, and I pay attention to those anecdotes. What happened in 1955 that could be a goalpost for the new administration?
Well, the precedent that we raised within this is that when Dwight Eisenhower came into office, he actually changed out the entire Joint Chiefs of Staff. So got a new chairman, got a new leader of the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy. So he swept the board and brought in an entire new team because he wanted to have a significant change in the strategic direction of the Department of Defense. That team actually, in many ways had failures. So there was a disagreement between Eisenhower and his chief of naval operations, Admiral Kearny. And Kearny was let go after only 2 years because he wasn't in line with the innovative changes that Eisenhower wanted to do, specifically the integration of nuclear-equipped missiles onto submarines and ships. And so Carney was retired, and they reached down 108 numbers down the lineal list and elevated Rear Admiral, two-star, Arleigh Burke to become the new Chief of Naval Operations because Burke was seen as an innovative leader and dynamic leader. Burke ended up serving 6 years, the longest-serving Chief of Naval Operations in the history of that office.
Captain Jerry Hendricks, United States Navy retired aviator, writing for National View Online with his colleague Brent Sadler about what is the problem to be fixed and when we come back, what is to be done.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.